Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Things have certainly escalated in terms of confrontation and violence in Cairo and Alexandria, and it's spreading across Egypt. The problem for me is knowing that people like Anderson Cooper or Christiane Amanpour or David Muir and their respective producers and camera crews are being attacked. The people that should be attacked are people like John Negroponte, people like George Herbert Walker Bush, the people who have formulated U.S. foreign policy over the past 30 years. Why attack members of the press? I realize that the press in this country is pretty weak and feeble. But why go after Anderson Cooper? Why not demand public trials for Dick Cheney and Elliot Abrams and the rest of these neocon bastards who have used the Egyptian people in their little chess game all these years? There is no question. If you have any question about this, you indicate that you are some kind of a right-wing freak. There is no question that the violence today was engineered by Mubarak and his thugs. This was so much like a bunch of brown shirts. When I watched those people on the horseback and the camels riding in the crowd of demonstrators, I'm surprised that they weren't all dragged off their horses and murdered on the spot. It's turned a corner. This is what we were talking about last night. My fear was that on Friday there would be violence. Well, it started. There's a chance on Friday it's going to get even worse. A couple of emails here about this, and we're going to cover some of this again tonight because I just think it's a critical issue. So much is riding on the outcome of this particular revolution and the ones to come. And I honestly believe that what we're seeing here, for whatever reason, there's some indications that these rebellions are happening, among other reasons, because of the scarcity of food and the escalation of food prices. I'm going to get to that in a second. But it's not going to stop with Egypt. What was it yesterday? The Jordanian king fired everybody, fired his entire cabinet. It's going to start over again. That's not going to work. They have released food supplies that were being held. There's an effort being made by some of these governments to subsidize food now. This is something, if you remember, all you cynics, this is something Prairie 2, our economic affairs correspondent, has been talking about was going to happen for the past 2 years. The scarcity of food. And he keeps saying, buy canned goods, put them aside. Anyway, we're going to get a couple of emails here. Edie in Atlanta writes, Mike, the stammering Obama press puppet, that would be Robert Gibbs, is still speaking in vague a-hole speak. If Obama or any of his gang had any guts, any leadership skills, Mubarak would be told to get out, leave office now. Or the days of $1 and $1.5 billion and $1.2 billion from the U.S. are over. Why would he care? He and his wealth can fly to Saudi Arabia, as did the former so-called president of Tunisia after his wife looted the bank. Pro-government protesters, quote, quote, are routing the people in the Cairo square. This gang is made up of the hated police, out of uniform, of course. I'm so sick and tired of being outed as the international monster we are. On the other hand, if it means freedom for these people, a life worth living, then I'm glad. We should be ashamed to keep up the pretense. Gas canisters marked Made in America. That's the USA all over. You know, this is very hard on Americans as observers. You know, this is not about us. I don't care how many people try to tell you it's about us. Even if I slip and say that it's about us, it's not about us. There are some consequences for us, but this is not about us. And the people in this country who are genuinely concerned about liberty and equality and solidarity, people like Code Pink. And by the way, I got an email from one of the listeners tonight. Code Pink is on the ground in Cairo. Bob Alexander's chat page. Somebody said there are all sorts of pictures. I went to it, and I don't have the URL, so don't ask me how to get there. But there are dozens of pictures. Code Pink, Ahmadiyya Benjamin, are on the ground in Cairo. There are a lot of people in this country who can't get to Cairo, who are in sympathy with what the people of Egypt are saying with this revolution, that they've had enough. And the fact that we, once again, are the bad guys. I mean, we are. I don't care how you want to spin it. And Jesus Christ is the right wing spinning it like crazy. Mort Zuckerman, a Zionist from the word go, former owner of U.S. News and World Report, had a interview where was it? I don't know. I don't care. Somebody sent me a link to it. But he blames the American left for this. He blames the people who criticize Israel for this. So the neocons in this country, I hope this scares the living hell out of them. I hope they realize what their policies have helped unleash. Now, if the result is death and destruction and fire and burning and murder and mayhem, there's no way anyone of conscience can support that. If the result is the overthrow of these dictatorships, whether they are in the Middle East, whether they are in the Far East, whether they are in Africa, whether, it doesn't make any difference. Wherever these dictatorships exist, most of which we support, we fund, we underwrite. If it means the end of these dictatorships and a period of chaos afterwards, well, as Stokely Carmichael said after the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the chickens are coming home to roost, which is a very cynical / realistic comment to have made almost 50 years ago. But here we are. We do it again and again and again. And then when the revolution comes, the neoconservative right wing in this country, the neo-fascist right wing in this country, go berserk and try to blame, oh, I don't know, people who say things like what I say, or what Ralph Nader says, or Chris Hedges says, or Mahdia Benjamin says, or Noam Chomsky says. I don't mean to put myself in that group. Excuse me. I didn't mean that. I just mean this little 25-cent radio program seems to piss off an awful lot of people. But the somebody described it today as a line in the concrete, not a line in the sand, but a line in the concrete has now been crossed. Anyone who thought Mubarak was going to pack up his tent and steal into the desert is crazy. That is not going to happen. And what is going to happen, I do believe, these dictators don't give a goddamn about their own people. They never have. Tell me Pol Pot was interested in his countrymen. Tell me Hitler was. Tell me Dick Cheney was. Tell me Mubarak is interested. Tell me, just pick a despot. Pick a tyrant. Tell me Saddam Hussein was. Tell me, pick one. So Mubarak is not going to end his life as being the ruler of Egypt that was tossed out on his ass. There is going to be bloodshed in the Middle East that is going to be scary. I'm not trying to be trite. I just don't know what other word to use. Somebody, I've got an email here that I'll share with you in a second. Somebody who thinks that the whole uprising was CIA-inspired. I don't agree with that. I think the reaction now is CIA-inspired. Remember the other night we talked about Negroponte, this ghoulish son of a bitch, and some of these other neocons immediately flocked there because, uh-oh, freedom, democracy, oh no, we'll have none of that. And then the violence began. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
The poor, all he ever gave to them was a war. You're listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Past the hour from Stan, who writes regarding Egypt and the Tea Party in this country. What the Tea Party wants us to riot or revolt for is not what people riot for. In fact, it is what the Tea Party wants that creates riots and revolutions. Excellent point. It is when the middle class disappears, as in the French Revolution. It is when food prices escalate out of reasonable range, and when there is actually no bread to eat, and when the peasants are crapped upon heartily, that the people, enraged, topple governments. It is those things that the Tea Party wants. No health care, delete Social Security, delete Medicare. That will create the egregious conditions we see behind revolutions. We see it today in dramatic TV from the Middle East. What say, Stan? Yeah, the teabag people in this country, I don't think they have no political philosophy at all. They are manipulated by the ultra wealthy, like the Koch brothers, the billionaires, who use these people as a diversion. Even to the point of funding them and giving them simplistic messages so they can get elected to the legislative branch of government in this country. But the teabaggers themselves, there is no agenda. They have no program. They have no ideas. They are convenient and willing stooges for the billionaires, the ultra-capitalists, who to some degree do this for sport. Set people against each other, and cause chaos, because with their billions, they can ride above this. The day will come when they cannot ride above it. The day will come when they are pulled down to the point where they can be dealt with, on a realistic level, not on a level, that they're on now, where they think, well, you know, I can get away with this stuff because I'm a billionaire. Nobody can touch me. I can hire my own private army. As a matter of fact, I have, you know, that sort of thing. So, as far as the Tea Party, the teabaggers themselves, again, these are useful dunces and stooges and idiots. They do what they're told. They follow the mad ravings that come over the radio and television from the Rupert Murdoch terrorist broadcast organization. It can't continue to happen in this country. I would hate to think that what is occurring in Egypt is a precursor or a peek into the future as to what's going to happen in this country. Now, the person who sent me this, Cheryl, she writes, Mike, I've been watching the Egyptian Love Fest on the American TV networks, and it's really frightened me because I'm trying to figure out what's really going on over there. For the past 2 years, the entire world has been rioting over issues that vary from food shortages to tuition increases. If we're allowed to hear about these incidents at all, it's in a three-paragraph blurb on page A20 of the newspaper. We most especially are not allowed to see photos or video of protests. Yet suddenly, we've been deluged 24-7 with nonstop coverage. My local paper is LA Times, and they've been carrying numerous photos as well as five pages of stories. I've been extremely alarmed to see this. Someone wants us to watch this uprising and support Mubarak's ouster. Why? Who's pushing it? The pictures on TV of flower-draped tanks rolling down the streets with happy, smiling college students riding on top of them was too eerily reminiscent of the scenes in Baghdad when people tore down the Hussein statue. As we learned later, it was all staged as propaganda for the U.S. masses to make us happy about the shock and awe. So what's really going on in Cairo? As you know, Mubarak is our dictator, put in place and supported by us. If he's about to be deposed, it can only be because he's no longer useful to us, or he's crossed the wrong people, meaning he's thwarting some U.S. mega corporation. What is the reason the U.S. wants him gone? We all need to ask this question. You'll never make me believe that it was a spontaneous populist revolt. The CIA's hands are all over this, and if the CIA is involved, it's always creepy. We'll end up with the wrong people in charge at the end, which will be a disaster for the people of Egypt. Now, there's more to this, and I'm going to do it when we come back after the break here. Cheryl offers three possibilities of what's really happening. Up to this point, I tend to disagree with what she's saying. I don't think the CIA staged this at all. Now, in the second part of her email, though, she makes a good she makes a couple of good arguments for that point of view, that somehow it was inspired, if not led, by American operatives. It's something to think about before you say, who is this crazy broad that sent Mike this email? Listen to what the rest of what she has to say when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds just, people gonna rise up, get their share. Gonna rise up and take what's there.
Screaming with Mike Malloy.
Revolution. 25 before the hour, I'm reading from an email Cheryl sent me. Her belief that the timing of this populist revolution in Egypt is suspect. She thinks it may be that the CIA's hands are all over this. And as she writes, and if the CIA is involved, it's always creepy. We end up with the wrong people in charge in the end, which would be a disaster for the people of Egypt. And she goes on, I've come up with three possibilities as to what's really happening, but you have such a great and realistic take on U.S. foreign policy and our sordid history. I'm curious as to your opinion. Here's number one. As oil prices rise, there have been rumors of possible oil deposits on Egypt's Red Sea coast. It contains some of the world's most pristine beaches and generates enormous tourist income for the Egyptian economy. Supposedly, Mubarak has refused to let any oil companies drill exploratory wells in the area. Have the U.S. oil companies grown tired of waiting? Has the U.S. government decided to put someone in place who will be more amenable to the wishes of these rapacious companies? Mubarak was complicit in the rendition and torture carried out. This is number two. Mubarak was complicit in the rendition and torture carried out by our government over the past decade. He happily tortured those whom we were too cowardly to torture ourselves. Lawsuits against the CIA, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others are popping up all over the globe by maimed people seeking justice and compensation to pay for the recovery and long-term care. Has Mubarak decided to cooperate with these plaintiffs? If so, he's certainly a danger to many powerful people in the U.S. Perhaps he needs to be discredited and silenced. And then third, 2 weeks ago, there was a huge document leak about the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Then a week ago, this protest movement started. Mubarak has always been a major player in any talks, and it can't be a coincidence that this started so soon after the release of the documents. Is there info buried in the documents or coming in future releases that detail his complicity in a way that will embarrass the U.S. government or powerful people at the defense or state departments? The CIA's fingers are all over the so-called populist uprising, and as you know, when the CIA is involved, it will only end badly for the local population. After the U.S. media conglomerates leave and the TV cameras are packed away, what will become of the Egyptian people who dared to speak out? Cheryl. Okay, I tend to disagree, Cheryl, with all three of your possibilities here. As far as oil off the Red Sea coast, it would not make sense for Mubarak to refuse exploratory wells. I mean, the income that he would get from that and the income that he could get under the table from that would be enormous. So I would discount your first one. Your second one, as far as Mubarak cooperating in a court of law, he couldn't do that without implicating himself. I mean, if you were involved in murdering someone and decided to rat that person out, you would be tried as a conspirator. So, your number two is, I don't think so. And number three, as far as the document leak about the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, I think you give Mubarak way too much credit. Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was an Egyptian socialist. He overthrew, I think it was King Farouk. Is that right? If it's not, I'll get emails. King Farouk, and who was the king of Egypt. And Nasser did this when? In the late 40s, early 50s? Don't email me. I just know it happened. Nasser tried to set up a pan-Arabic socialism. He aligned himself with the Soviet Union, which immediately put him on the U.S. Crap list. Okay, when Nasser died, Sadat took over. Now, Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak all come from the military, so there's never been any democracy, as we would like to think about it, in this country, at least not since the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. So. And prior to that, too. Jesus. So next in line was Anwar Sadat. He was not a socialist. He immediately switched, not immediately, but over a very short period of time, he switched the alignment of Egypt away from the Soviet Union to the United States. And he was assassinated. Sitting next to him when the assassins went after Sadat was Mubarak. And this was 29, 30 years ago. Mubarak then became the dictator. Now, here's the reason I don't think your number three about the document leak about the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and Mubarak being a player is valid. Mubarak is not a player in anything. He's a thug. He is a former colonel in the Air Force. Is that what Mubarak was? A colonel in the Air Force? He's a halfwit. He's a moron. He's not a statesman. He's not a revolutionary. He understands power from the barrel of a gun. He didn't give a damn about what happens between the Israelis and the Palestinians. He couldn't care less as long as the money keeps coming from the United States and as long as he got Sinai back. One of the most embarrassing things in the 67 war, the horribly embarrassing thing for the Egyptians, was the loss of Sinai to the Israeli, you know, the Israelis' tanks. It was like blitzkrieg. I'm sorry, that's not a good term to use about a Jewish military, but it was like a blitzkrieg that came roiling across the Sinai Peninsula right up to the edge of the Suez Canal. And had the Egyptians not immediately stopped their participation, the Israelis did. They had to be talked to very sternly by somebody about not taking the Suez. So the humiliation that was there as a result of the 67 war at the hands of the Israelis, I think, left the Egyptian leadership in this frame of mind. Even though they had some successes in the 72 war, the Egyptian Air Force, I'm not saying they're a bunch of wimps. I'm not. It's just that the lightning strike in 67, was so unnerving to the Egyptians. So all they wanted to do is have what we used to call détente. No conflict. If there is conflict, it's done by surrogates. It's done beneath the table. The Egyptians allow the tunnels to go into Gaza. The Egyptians make a big show about closing the tunnels or blocking the supply of food and medicine to Gaza. Mubarak was like, he had no ambition. He was nothing, in my opinion. He was nothing. He wanted the money. He wanted the power. He wanted to be dictator for life, which he has been, and that's it. So based on that, when you say, Sheryl, Mubarak has always been a major player in any talks, I disagree. I don't think he's been a major player at all. And how could he have been? He had a peace agreement. The Egyptians had a peace agreement with Israel, which meant essentially that no matter what atrocities the Israelis commit against the Palestinians, Mubarak could only scratch his ass and burp a little bit and say, well, are you sure you want to do that? So anyway, you asked my opinion, Sheryl. There it is. Now, as far as CIA involvement, I think the involvement came yesterday and well, yesterday in Egypt. It would be our today and tonight. I think the CIA, John Bolton and Negroponte and the rest of these demons, and they are demons. They're flesh-eating, ghoulish demons. I think they have made their presence known in Egypt and have told Mubarak, look, you know, we want you to stay where you are. We don't trust any kind of new leadership. A spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood was all over radio and television today, NPR, I think CNN, The World, and BBC. And the spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood keeps assuring people that assuring people outside of Egypt that they are not interested in establishing an Islamic State. The right-wing crazy people in this country, which are the ones who run media, the ones who maintain the status quo in this country, driving everything to the edge of the cliff, they want you to see the spokesperson for the Muslim Brotherhood as a liar. I don't think, I would tend to agree with what the man said. I don't think they're interested in turning Egypt into a Muslim state at all. So, I don't know. This stuff is so out of my realm of even understanding. Oh, sure, I understand the history of the area. I understand some of the conflicts. I understand the religious insanity. I understand the dictatorships and the interplay with all the other dictatorships in that area. But just keep in mind something about the Middle East or North Africa. Everything ultimately is an illusion. We'll be right back. Before the hour, got an email from someone who, a couple of people who have said that the chickens coming home to roost was really Malcolm X. Originally, yes, it was Stokely Carmichael, though, who popularized the phrase, and it had to do with the assassination of Kennedy. But yeah, I guess Malcolm X did start it. So, start the saying. The way the Associated Press reported, I'm sure you saw it today, but supporters of Mubarak charged into Cairo's central square on horses and camels. I couldn't believe that. And they were brandishing whips and other thugs, brown shirts, the type that would do what Glenn Beck would tell them to do, or what the coward Bill O'Reilly, or the drug addict Rush Limbaugh, or the little puppet boy Sean Hannity, but especially the insane person Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck knows that out there he has his brain-dead army of followers. And this is what the Beck punk asses would do, exactly what these punk asses did for Hosni Mubarak. Drop firebombs from rooftops in what appeared to be an orchestrated assault against protesters trying to topple Mubarak. Three people died so far. This was this afternoon. 600 were injured. The protesters accused Mubarak's regime of unleashing a force of paid thugs. That would be Glenn Beck. And plainclothes police. That would be the Blackwater people. To crush their unprecedented nine-day-old movement a day after Mubarak refused to step down. They showed off police ID badges they said were wrestled from their attackers. Some government workers said their employers ordered them into the streets. Mustafa al-Fiqi, a top official from the ruling National Democratic Party, told the Associated Press that businessmen connected to the ruling party were responsible for what happened. See, this has got there's no connection to Beck in Egypt that we're aware of. But if this ever happens in America, Glenn Beck is going to be the one who tries to maintain the gangster capitalism status quo and call on his crazy people out here in his audience to try to turn the tide of a populist revolution that may happen in this country at some point. The notion, the AP says, that the state may have coordinated violence against protesters who had kept a peaceful vision of a vigil in Tahrir Square for 5 days prompted a sharp rebuke from the Obama administration. Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said, quote, if any of the violence is instigated by the government, it should stop immediately. When I heard that quoted today, I wanted to call up Robert Gibbs and say, did you feel this way when you were, or when the government of the, not you, Gibbs, but when the government of the United States was sending people to Egypt for torture? And reports say that the rendition process hasn't stopped yet. So can you not be a hypocrite, Mr. Gibbs? Gibbs said, quote, the United States deplores and condemns the violence that is taking place in Egypt. We do? I thought we promoted violence and torture. Didn't we? Or are we going to parse it down here and say, well, Jesus Christ, Mike, we only sent maybe 30 or 40 people there to have their eyes gouged out and their testicles crushed and their fingernails pulled off their fingers. 30 or 40 people. These bastards have got a million in the streets. What are you talking about, Malloy? Gibbs says, quote, the United States deplores and condemns the violence that is taking place in Egypt, and we are deeply concerned about attacks on the media and peaceful demonstrators. We repeat our strong call for restraint, end quote. You know, that would carry a lot more weight, Mr. Gibbs, if you would follow up with, oh, and by the way, we deeply apologize for the criminal gangster acts of the administration of the United States immediately preceding this one. A, B, we are going to close Guantanamo tomorrow. C, we're going to close Bagram Air Base. D, we're going to stop sending people to Egypt to have their goddamn eyes gouged out. Now I'm getting pissed off. See how easy it is? Obama said earlier, quote, now it is not the role of any other country to determine Egypt's leaders. Mr. President, with all due respect, how can you say that when the United States has propped up this dictator for 30 years with billions upon billions, maybe as much as 60 or 70 billion goddamn U.S. dollars. What are you talking about, Mr. Obama? If it is not the role of the United States to determine Egypt's leaders, then Mr. Obama, why didn't you follow that up by saying, we deeply apologize for what we have done to the people of Egypt over the past 30 years, and starting tomorrow, there will not be another goddamn dime go to a dictator. Oh, excuse me. I'm yelling again. I just get very upset when I hear the press secretary and the president involved in massive amounts of gross hypocrisy. You want it to stop, Mr. President? You can stop it tomorrow. Just cut the son of a bitch off. That's all you have to do. That's a good starting point. And stop sending him people to torture. No? Can't do it? Okay. I'm watching CNN, Anderson Cooper and Ben Wiedemann, the CNN reporter in the Middle East for a long time, are discussing the fact, Wiedemann is, and by the way, heavy gunfire now in Cairo. Wiedemann was pointing out that for the past 19 hours now, there have been these running battles between the anti-Mubarak Democrats, people who are wanting democracy, and the thugs who are put out there by Mubarak or the CIA or whomever to cause the bloodshed and the death. 19 hours, and the army and the police force have not stepped in yet to separate or to make it stop, which is a clear indication to anyone with a more than a third grade education that the government is behind sending the thugs in to do this murder and this damage and the beatings. And so, again, I don't think there's any doubt that this is going to turn exceedingly bloody before it ends. Andre writes, watching Al Jazeera online, peaceful protests became violent when pro-Mubarak, quote, supporters, end quote, attacked protesters with weapons. Supporters consisting of criminals and secret police. Can anyone say Negroponte, El Salvador, Chile, Argentina? United States gangster capitalists want, above all else, instability, chaos, a vacuum so that autocrats can fill the void. It goes on and on and on throughout history. Triangulation is merely about keeping things mysterious and unstable by feeding both sides. Calling for democracy when supporting tyranny, or calling for democracy when supporting tyranny, if there was even a pretense of keeping peace, Mubarak would be on a plane for Washington. Cynical? Yes, I know. Well, a cynic is somebody who's finally decided to use his or her own brain and the brain power contained therein and come to obvious conclusions. I want to throw this into the mix because it may be heavy gunfire in Cairo, CNN is reporting. You should probably, I hate to say this, but in a situation like this, CNN and Al Jazeera provide some pretty intense coverage. Either one at this point. Economists and experts in food security. This is from McClatchy Newspapers yesterday, I think, have warned repeatedly in recent years that an unbridled rise in food prices could trigger the very kind of explosion of citizen anger that's now threatening to topple the Egyptian government. Such anger is likely to rise elsewhere, too. Now, the McClatchy, Kevin Hall, writing at McClatchy, is not suggesting it's only about food. Of course not. But this is one of those elements, unquantifiable in terms of the extent to which food prices or lack of food is pushing some of this. As Hall says, a large nation with lots of desert, Egypt must import more than half of its food supply. Since 2008, there have been sporadic unrest there, Egypt, as the cost of staples from bread to fruit to vegetables has gone up steadily. One of those warning about the food prices was Hamdi Abdel Azim, an economist and former president at the Sadat Academy for Social Sciences in Cairo. He told the Interpress service in mid-November, quote, if the rise in food costs persists, there will be an explosion of popular anger against the government, end quote. Now, that was back in November. And a few weeks earlier, before that, political opponents of Mubarak had rallied to protest rising prices and to demand price ceilings on products to protect Egypt's poor. And as McClatchy points out, soaring food prices aren't the only reason Egyptians took to the streets to try to topple their long-serving president, but they're a significant factor. And a steady surge in global commodity prices reminiscent of 2008 is sure to bring new battles over food security this year. Protests against food prices recently rocked Jordan and Algeria. The same rising prices were partly why Tunisia's dictator Ben Ali fled his nation in mid-January. India and China are navigating the difficult waters of trying to control rising prices in their populous nations. In the trading pits of commodity markets, the buzz is that many poor nations are trying to hoard wheat, corn, and other staples. Such stockpiling has added to the bullish sentiment that's driving commodity prices even higher. A senior market analyst for commodities trader PFG Best in Chicago said, quote, countries are hoarding grain supplies right now because they don't want to see what's happening in Egypt happen to them, end quote. Of course, these commodities traders, I know you can make an argument both ways, right? But the commodities traders are the ones, I think, that drive this chaos. You know, people talk about the operation of the free market. Commodities traders destroy the free market. They drive the prices up, they drive the prices down, they take their cut, they run with the money. When they drive the prices up, the farmers love them, and the farmers say, oh, well, see, this is how we can, those future trading contracts that are sold, this is how we know we can plant an extra 100 acres or an extra 1,000 acres, because 8 months from now, those contracts are sold at that price. Well, that's hog snot. What about the other way? 8 months from now, the market collapses, and what happens to the farmer? It's just another form of gangster capitalism, goddammit. It really is. Now, somebody wants to argue with me about that, go ahead and send me an email. But for U.S. farmers, Egypt presents, according to McClatchy, Egypt presents the eighth largest export market, much of it wheat sales, since that country is the world's leading wheat importer. Egypt. American wheat and corn are sold across North Africa and the Middle East, prompting worries by U.S. farmers that Egypt's problems will spread throughout the region. And then it talks about the way the prices are manipulated. Senior Director of International Operations for the U.S. Grains Council, which represents U.S. farmers, said the issues in Egypt right now are basic. The government must function for banks to open, for payments to get transacted, for commodities to be purchased, end quote. And what is driving the food price situation, of course, is global climate change. Some of the story is directly related to that. Argentina, Australia, and Pakistan have suffered from heavy rains, which have damaged crop production. Russia is recovering from a devastating drought and heat wave last year during the growing season. And it's only going to get worse and worse and worse. And in the meantime, we are going to beat up on each other as to who gets the front row seat in God's little niche in heaven. Is it going to be the Muslims, the Jews, or the Christians? And until that's decided, let's continue to kill each other. Let's continue to invade each other. And the other argument will be who gets to own all the natural resources here on Earth before we all do die. Is it going to be the Saudis, the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, or the Indians? And in the meantime, let's kill each other and ignore the overarching problem of the human race being in absolute jeopardy as to whether or not we're going to survive another 100 years. Let's ignore that. Right? That doesn't make any sense at all. Let's ignore that. Let's fight about who gets to see God first. Is it going to be the Jews? They claim to be the chosen people. No, it's going to be the Muslims because they have, through their prophet, a direct line. No, it's going to be the Christians because the Christians said, no. The Jews were on the right track and then they got sidetracked. We're on the right track and we'll kill anybody that disagrees with us. And the Muslims say, no. We'll kill anybody that has the temerity to disagree with us. And the Jews say, ah, screw all of you. Theology 101 on the Molloy program. We'll be right back.
Radio done right, from the left, it's Mike Molloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Hey, guess what? You want some really weird news here? I think it's weird, yeah, on so many different levels. If I can get away from heavy gunfire in Cairo just for a moment. Let's pretend it's just a normal Wednesday night. Scientists have found a new solar system. A solar system. However, it's a little weird. The astronomers are saying, or the astrophysicists are saying, it is so unlike our own solar system that at first glance it seems almost impossible it could exist. According to what I have here, and I have no idea where it's from, Scientific American, I don't know. The planets in this new system are packed together as densely as fans in a mosh pit. Ooh! Five planets sit practically on top of each other as they circle the star. It's called Kepler 11. And a sixth planet circles further out. Two of the planets lie together closer than any other known pair of planets outside our solar system. I mean, can you imagine what it must be like if you were on the surface of one of those planets with the binary, I don't know they're binary planets or not, but they're very close together, and you step outside, instead of the moon up there, you see this great big thing right in front of you in the sky. Kind of like that. Remember the movie, I saw it when I was a kid, When Worlds Collide, the H.G. Wells, I think it was H.G. Wells, wasn't it? When Worlds Collide, and there were two planets going to swing by Earth. The first one was going to miss us. but it was going to come close enough to cause earthquakes and tidal waves and death and destruction. And the second one was going to slam right into Earth and destroy the whole thing. So the plot was to build a spaceship and big enough to take maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people and escape to the first planet as it came by, to jump on board the spaceship and get on that planet and go on. And great stuff back in the mid-50s. Yeah, it was like, oh, yeah. Well, the fun part of the movie was how they selected, let's see, back then I think there was about 2 billion people on Earth, maybe a billion and a half, 2 billion. But how you selected 2,000 people or 1,500, whatever it was in the movie plot, to, oh, never mind. Oh, the point I was trying to get at was the scenes in the movie. Now, as a little kid, I was watching this freaking out because on the movie screen, when they showed the second or the first planet as it roared by, I mean, it was this huge thing. And it was just scary as hell. And then the second one, of course, was coming on a direct collision course. Anyway, so this new solar system has been discovered, and it's only, how far away is it? It's in the constellation Cygnus. It's only 2,000 light years away from Earth, so traveling at the speed of light, it'll only take you 2 millennia to get there. A scientist for NASA at a news conference today said there's only one word to describe the new solar system. And this is why we don't have a space program. This is what he said. There's only one word to describe this new solar system, and it's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That's what a NASA physicist, astrophysicist said. Other astronomers tossed around the words like amazing and remarkable to describe the new system. The six planets of this system, Kepler-11, may be among the latest entries on the list of extrasolar planets. You see, here we are again with the heliocentric idea that, oh, we're the center. Well, no, not that we're the center, but those outside our own solar system. And, of course, they're not going to be the last. There are estimates of billions of planets out there. And I just, you know, I just wish there was some way that I could be alive, and I probably will not be, when life is discovered on a different planet. Because at that moment, and I'm talking about any kind of life, microbes, little creepy crawly things, microscopic creatures, because in that particular moment, the Christians, Muslims, and Jews see their whole religious structure disappear if they pay attention to what they're seeing. The entire structure is gone because they all base their God heaven theories on the book of Genesis, and well, you get it. Now, how did Noah get? Oh, never mind. So I just wish there was some way. Now, a lot of people disagree and say, well, no, Mike, that'll strengthen it. That means God is all over the place. No, it doesn't, jackass. It means that Judaism, Islam, and Christianity crash and burn. What a glorious day that'll be. We'll be right back.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malone.
25 before the hour. Linda writes, Mike, I've been listening to you since you were with Air America. I think these pro-Mubarak terrorists are Egyptian Tea Partiers, and I think the right-wingers who are behind the Tea Partiers in the United States helped cause these horrible attacks on these peaceful protesters. This is breaking my heart. My heart's been breaking a lot ever since 2000. You know they're getting paid just like the Tea Partiers here get paid. Peace, Linda. Yeah, the forces that... she's right. There's no question. The money that goes to support the dictators that we support comes from essentially the same source. For example, the Koch brothers, as the money that is used to, back these crazy ass teabag candidates who are empty headed. They are a diversionary tactic. The American political system focuses on them instead of focusing on a way to eliminate gangster capitalism from our society if we're going to survive. So, yeah, Linda's absolutely right. There's no question about it. It's the same kind of predatory bastards who really just don't care. But the Koch brothers will back a dictator like Mubarak the same way they will back a moron like pick one from this last political season. Oh, you know, this I hate to bring this up. It just seems so trite. But here we go again. A federal appeals court ruled unanimously today that a local trial judge in Ohio, which is really turning into fascism central. It's a toss-up between Ohio and Arizona. I mean, it really is. Forget the sick, waddling bastards here in the South. I mean, Ohio. Anyway, that this judge has no constitutional right to hang in his courtroom a poster of the Ten Commandments along with his own pointed comments about, quote, moral relativism, end quote, in the rule of law. The U.S. Sixth District Court of Appeals declared in a 17-page order that the presence of the poster in the courtroom of Richland County Common Pleas Court Judge James DeWeese violated the First Amendment rights of lawyers and litigants appearing before him. Asserting that the judge's so-called secular justification for the written message was a sham, the federal appellate judges affirmed a lower court ruling ordering this dumbass to take down the poster. Why does this keep coming up? You know, doesn't this sound similar to Sharia law, Muslim law? And aren't the right-wing nuts in the U.S. insisting Sharia law has infiltrated the U.S. court system? You know, that's another red herring. What is infiltrating the U.S. court system is this fundamentalist, mouth-breathing, arm-waving, eye-rolling, snake-handling, psychotic Christianity that is in every degree as bad and maybe worse than psychotic Islam. Anyway, here's what's hung on his courtroom wall in this half-assed judge's courtroom since 2006. A poster including the following comments from the judge himself, which is right above the list of the commandments, that figures. He writes, quote, "There is a conflict of legal and moral philosophies raging in the United States. That conflict is between moral relativism and moral absolutism. We are moving toward moral relativism. All law is legislated morality." It is? "The only question is whose morality? Because morality is based on faith, there is no such thing as religious neutrality in law or morality." Are you getting this? Are you getting this? This sounds like Mullah Halfwit someplace in some back-assward village in darkest Afghanistan. That's what this guy sounds like. He goes on, quote, "Ultimately, there are only two views. Either God is the final authority, and we acknowledge his unchanging standard of behavior, or man is the final authority." I'll go with man, you dumbass. "And standards of behavior change at the whim of individuals or societies." This is what this guy has up. I see. Well, the Bible says that slaves are supposed to respect their masters and do what their masters tell them. Human beings come up with emancipation proclamations. Well, I guess this sick bastard. He goes on. Quote, the cases passing through this courtroom demonstrate we are paying a high cost in increased crime and other social ills for moving from moral absolutism to moral relativism since the mid-20th century. Really? Is that when it happened? The mid-20th century? That's when we passed civil rights laws. That's when we, never mind. Our founder saw the necessity of moral absolutes. The Declaration of Independence acknowledges God as creator, lawgiver, supreme judge of the world. It does? Son of a bitch, judge, which Declaration of Independence are you talking about, boss? And the one who providentially superintends the affairs of men. Ohio's Constitution acknowledges Almighty God as the source of our freedom. No, you don't get freedom from God, you half-wit moron. You get slavery from God. I mean, the Ten Commandments, what is it, seven of them are God saying, you better kiss my ass or I will rip your head off and your family and all of your people and your village. That's not freedom, Judge. I joined the founders in personally acknowledging the importance of Almighty God's fixed moral standards for restoring the moral fabric of this nation. End quote. Now, if that doesn't sound, like I said, if that doesn't sound like a bunch of these creepy-ass mullahs sitting around, say, you know, eight or nine of them in a circle with their asses in the mud, and they're sitting there going, well, I think we need to stone the woman to death. Yes, I think so, too. Wasn't she? She was out in public with her face visible. Yes, kill the bitch. Okay, how are we going to do it? Well, let's bury her. I'll tell you what. Let's strip her and bury her up to her waist. And we'll bind her hands. That way, when we start throwing the rocks, and we'll make all the villagers come out and throw the rocks, some of them will hit her breasts, and we can watch a lot of bleeding. So let's get her out here. We have ruled. Aye, 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 aye. We have ruled. Inshallah. And this guy is the same. We have to acknowledge the importance of Almighty God's fixed moral standards. Nothing changes. Bring her into my courtroom. Let's stone her. Oh, wait. I'm not supposed to say that, am I? I'm an American judge. No, you don't have to worry. The point is, how many of these right-wing, who's the guy I was just talking about the other night? Frank Gaffney, the psychopath, this crazy bastard who says that Sharia advocates have infiltrated the inner circle of the Muslim Kenyan Barack Obama's government! Well, again, the French intellectual revolutionary, Denis Diderot, who said, something to this effect, man will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. Amen! Hallelujah! Until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. Then, freedom. And this half-witted judge in Ohio. No! Moral relativism! Well, if it weren't for moral relativism, Judge, I'd like to know your background. Deweys, what kind of a name is that? Is that Dutch? What is Deweys? Chances are your family'd still be growing tulips in Holland someplace. I don't know. I don't know who you are. I don't care who you are. But if I ever came into your courtroom, I would drop my pants and relieve myself right on your desk, you psycho. My God. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I have I can't do it right now. We have an Uncle Mike story corner here. I have in my hand an Uncle Mike story corner, but I guess we're going to have to wait. Did I have something from Bob Alexander the other day? I don't think I did it. All right. Well, maybe we'll do both. Maybe we'll do an Uncle Mike story corner and a moment with Bob. That's what we'll do. The next hour should be just packed with fun. But we have one more segment in this hour. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. That wasn't true.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. What else have we got here? King of Jordan dismisses his cabinet. Oh, that's so yesterday. Of course, in his 12 years on the throne, King Abdullah, he's done that 8 times. You know, there's a guy who's figured out how to keep people from rioting in the streets. Every time they get together and say, wait a minute, we're sick of being ruled by a king. I mean, Jesus Christ, we're in the 21st century and there's no food. He fires his cabinet. Nice. I don't want to talk about the snow. The snow is awful. A lot of people say, why do you live in that crap hole, Georgia? Because we don't get this. Not like that. What else have I got here? Oh, yeah. On NBC Today Show yesterday, we roll out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning here and do an hour of local television news while we're getting Molly ready and Kathy gets ready. Kathy takes Molly to school. I fix Molly's breakfast. And then Kathy goes to this gym where she works out. And so I've got like an hour after they leave, which is around 7 o'clock, to go back to sleep, which I do sometimes. So other times I'll turn on NBC Today Show or ABC's Good Morning America and watch that, watch it for a while. I like to watch Judas Stephanopoulos. He just fascinates me, the way he plays stupid. He plays so stupid, he's not a stupid man. I digress. Anyway, on NBC Today Show yesterday, they had a young kid on who had been the victim of brutal bullying, a 13-year-old kid in Upper Darby, PA. 7 boys, and there was video. They took cell phone video of this, you see, as they beat this kid mercilessly. 7 boys are now arrested and being in juvenile detention. They're the ones who attacked him. Now, among the things that they screamed at him was queer and gay boy and so on and so forth. This is, you know, and they had the kid on camera, you know, and he said, you know, I'm not gay. I'm just a kid, but they always pick on me. They do this to me. Do you realize that fundamental Christians in this country say that there should be no, laws against this kind of bullying? The idea is that if a child happens to discover that he's gay and other kids pick up on it, then the Christian fundamentalists want the other kids to beat him and eventually kill him or make him commit suicide. They must, because if they don't want any protections for this child, this is what, this is, you know, just another in the long list of reasons why I will cut my own goddamn throat before I would ever subscribe to any of this religious nonsense. Just one, I mean, there's hundreds of reasons, but this happens to be one. You know, to say that there should be no, how do they put it, special protections for queers. God doesn't like queers. And I forget where in the Bible, after Jesus says, where he condemns people who would harm a child, condemns them. He says, suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. And I just wonder if these Christian bastard fundamentalists don't understand that. I mean, it's their God talking to them. The little children's. Now, it doesn't say, suffer the little children to come into me, except the queer ones, for such is the kingdom of heaven. You goddamn people, I tell you, I'm so sick of your hypocrisy. I'm so sick of your bloodletting. I'm so sick of what you have done with your religious nonsense. So here this little kid. Well, they call me gay. They call me gay. So they beat me up and they push me down. Cute little kid and his mom, you know, they had his mom on. And, you know, she, I mean, how does a parent react? I am so sick and tired of this caveman religious nonsense, this medieval horse crap that continues to murder and maim and kill and destroy and upset. Oh, I know. You're a Christian and you're highly pissed off now and you're going to stop listening to the program. You're going to tell all your friends to stop listening. Okay. You know, go ahead. You know, go ahead. I can do this later in the program. When we come, we're just about ready to take the top of the hour break here. When we come back, we've got Uncle Mike's Story Corner, written by Amanda Barkus. It's titled "My Unemployed Life." Just let me teach again, please. And I'm going to read this, and I selected as Uncle Mike's Story Corner selection tonight in recognition of what our education affairs correspondent, Kay Petrini, goes through. Kay is working. This woman isn't. But, I mean, you know, it's. I'm sure Kay will feel simpatico with this woman. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. All right, do we have Uncle Mike's Story Corner music? Ah, there it is. Is it ripped off from another program? Of course. This is Liberal Talk Radio. All we do is steal things. Gather around, kiddies. Got your jammies on. Ooh, it's so snowy out there and cold and nasty. Uncle Mike has a story for you tonight. Everybody comfy? All snuggled up? Tonight's story is written by Amanda Barkas, and it's entitled My Unemployed Life, Just Let Me Teach Again, Please. My name is Amanda. I am 30 years old, and for the last 18 months, I have been unemployed. In my previous life, the one where I had a job with great benefits, I was a high school English teacher. I taught for 6 years, blissfully unaware of just what happens when you lose the stability of a paycheck. I lost my job due to cutbacks. No one told me that the recession would affect the entire nation, especially my state of Michigan, so profoundly. My school district was in a deep financial hole, and when that happens, teachers lose their jobs, and I lost mine. So I started on my journey of finding a new job. I had no idea or understanding that I would still be unemployed a year and a half later. Doing everything right, when I first lost my job, I took all the most obvious steps that everyone in my situation takes. I signed up for unemployment, put my resume on countless online job hunting websites, and put the word out there to everyone I knew that I was looking for employment. Obviously, these tactics have not worked. I've been receiving unemployment insurance thanks to numerous extensions. I cross my fingers daily that they pass another extension. Even with the unemployment benefits, making ends meet has been rough. My benefits aren't enough to pay my monthly bills. Now, I'm not a person with huge amounts of credit card debts or extraneous expenses that need to be paid. We are talking just the basics here. Mortgage, car and insurance, phone, water, gas, electric, and groceries. That's it. No shopping sprees, no trips to the Caribbean, just your plain old average bills. Sinking from the stress. Since there just wasn't enough money to go around, I had to ask for help. Since my unemployment, my dad has been paying my car and insurance payments. I've had to borrow money at different times for unexpected expenses like repairs. The stress of scraping by financially has been more than I can bear at times. I've cried more times than I can count. I'm pretty sure I've gone through some serious bouts of depression, and I've turned into a hermit. I've pulled back from my friends and family because most days there's just too much to deal with. I can't answer one more question about my job search or my money situation. I can't listen to one more corny line that tells me, well, something good is bound to happen since you've already hit bottom. In terms of coping with the stress and overwhelming pressure of the situation, I can honestly say I haven't dealt with it well. When I try to think back over these many months on how many jobs I have searched out, applied for, and waited, hopefully, to hear back on, I've lost count. I've applied for hundreds of jobs. Out of hundreds, I've had two interviews. Two. Most times, when I send a resume, I never hear from that company again. Not a thanks, but no thanks, or we've decided to go with someone else, nothing. That would have to be one of the most frustrating aspects of this. You spend the time searching for a job, going through the extensive online application process, tailoring your cover letter and resume to fit the job, and then you send it into oblivion and never hear about it again. Trying to contact the company or follow up is impossible. No one has time for you. But what choice do I have? I have to find a job, and this is how it works. So every day I start the process over again and hope that today will be the day that something changes. Being a better mom, I can honestly say that this experience has given me an opportunity to be a better, it has made me a better mom. When I was working, I would come home exhausted after dealing with the kids all day. I had very little left to give to my own son. I'm a single parent, and it all falls to me. I would scrape together dinner, try to focus to help with homework, and then count the minutes until I could get some sleep. All that has changed. Now I take my son breakfast each morning and talk to him about his day. Now I make my son breakfast each morning and talk to him about his day. I get to drive him to school each day, a task I have never been able to do. It was always me rushing to get ready, then dropping him off at his grandparents so I could make the long drive into work. Nowadays, I also get to be a part of school field trips, sporting events, volunteer activities. I used to spend my days devoted to other people's kids. For a change, I can focus solely on mine. So while these 18 months have been incredibly hard to manage, they've also been a blessing. Being unemployed has really changed me as a person. On the positive side of things, I'm a more attentive parent. But honestly, this is the only positive to come from this. I have become more cynical and pessimistic. I used to be a happy person who didn't let anything get to me. I wish that were true now. Nowadays, I have a tendency to always look for the negative. I assume things will turn out badly, and I cry at the drop of a hat. And the worst part about it is that I'm internalizing all of this. I don't want to burden people any more than I already have, so I deal with the emotional fallout alone and have allowed it to bury me. I'm not the same me. That's hard to admit. I feel like I have lost a lot in this. I wish I knew what to do to change all of this, but I'm at my wit's end. And unfortunately, there's no end in sight. Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Not a very happy Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight, written by Amanda Barkas. Just let me teach again, please. Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by the murder capitalists at Offshore Drilling. And right on the heels of that, Republican governors take aim at teacher tenure. I guess you've heard about this. This is the big deal on the right wing. Gotta get rid of all those bad teachers! Tenure! Tenure! They don't teach! Poor student performance. Yeah, think about that. Poor student performance. What causes poor student performance? Republican governors are taking aim at a bedrock tradition of public schools, teacher tenure. The momentum began a year ago with Obama's call to measure and reward effective teaching. And he repeated that in last week's State of the Union address. What's it called? Race to the Top? Now, several Republican governors have concluded that removing teachers requires undoing the century-old protections of tenure. Governors in Florida, Idaho, Indiana, Nevada, New Jersey have called for the elimination or dismantling of tenure. As state legislatures convene this winter, anti-tenure bills are being written in those states and others. The chances of passing have risen because of crushing state budget deficits that have put teachers' unions on the defensive. Governor Brian Sandoval of Nevada, lamenting that his state has the lowest high school graduation rate in the nation, said, quote, "It's practically impossible to remove an underperforming teacher under the system we have now." Arr! End quote. Eliminating tenure, Governor Sandoval says, would allow school districts to dismiss teachers based on competence, not seniority, in the event of layoffs. Politics also plays a role. Michael Petrilli, an education official under President George W. Bush, said, quote, "These new Republican governors are trying to out-reform one another." Teachers' unions have responded to the assault on the status quo by arguing that all the ire directed at bad teachers distorts the issue. And you're damn right it does. I'm going to give you the other half of the story when we come back, okay? Teacher tenure, that's supposed to be a bad thing. Why? Because you have incompetent teachers. How do you know they're incompetent? Well, look at the grades the children are getting. Look how they're graduating. They can't read. They can't do math. They don't have any kind of science understanding. It's the dirty damn teachers and the dirty damn tenure. Is it really? Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
No more time.
right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
Okay, let's get rid of teacher tenure. All these Republican governors are saying, got to get rid of the bad teachers. Teachers unions have responded to this assault by arguing that all this, the conversation being generated by these crazy people on the right, most of whom are Christians who want to destroy public education anyway, obscures some pretty basic facts. Dennis Van Roekel, president of the National Education Association, said, quote, why aren't governors standing up and saying, in our state, we'll devise a system where nobody will ever get into a classroom who isn't competent, you know, a teacher. Instead, they're saying, let's make it easy to fire teachers. That's the wrong way to do it. And stop and think for a second. If all of it is based on student performance, which it is. What was the test Molly took a couple of months ago? Huh? The Kogan? Kogat. And she did fine on it, but it was testing over a 4 or 5 day period. She's in the first grade. Now, we happen to think that, that Molly, and she's in a public school, we happen to think that Molly has a pretty good teacher. And how many kids in her classroom? About 20. Now, there's no teaching assistant. There's no help. The teacher does it on her own. That's not true?
No, they do have a couple of what they call floating paraprofessionals. Plus, they have days when they go to the library and there's a media assistant that helps with the the kids with on the computers. And a parent is in that classroom every day for some reason, either reading to the kids.
Yeah, well, you do that.
They have the elementary school that Molly attends is one of the very few that can boast 110% of parental involvement. 110% of the parents are involved. And I say, how's that possible? Because a lot of grandparents and nannies and big sisters.
Right.
And family friends.
Okay, well, and I think you're making the point I'm trying to get to. Where Molly's teacher is a good teacher, there is tremendous support from what Kathy just said. Kathy has read to the kids maybe 3 or 4 times. I've gone twice. It's just a rotating thing that all the parents do. There are 500 kids in this school, right? 500? So it's not like a little dinky school. And it's part of a system that is in deep trouble here in Georgia. Trust me on that. But the school itself has done real well. Because of parent involvement. So, and there's no talk about ending tenure for these teachers. But what do these teachers have to work with? Do they have kids that come to class hungry? No. The kids that do come in hungry, they have a breakfast program there, don't they, Kathy? They have a breakfast program for low-income kids? Okay. So they don't go into classroom hungry. What about the teachers that have to deal with kids that are stressed out because their parents are unemployed? What about the kids that, how many times have some of these kids had to move within the district that we're talking about here? Where not even within the district. All of a sudden a teacher has kids show up that 6 months ago was living on the other side of town or a different state. I mean, how does a teacher deal with that, knowing that that child may only be in that classroom for 3 months? What about kids that are anxious and scared to death about what's going on because there's nothing solid in their lives? Their parents are fighting because of economic problems. If they have two parents, if they have one parent, that parent is struggling. I was a single parent and raised my son Chris over a 10 year period. And sometimes it's really, really difficult to do that. But being a white male, it was easier for me than a white female or a black male or a black female. I mean, I understand that. It was easier for me. Huh? What about kids who are ADD or kids that have they fall on the autism spectrum? What about those kids? What about the kids that are being attacked by bullies? What about the bullies themselves? What about the schools where there's no psychologist, there's no school nurse, where there are no counselors to help out? And all of that filters and funnels into a school classroom where there might be 35 students and no budget and the books suck and they're out of date and there are no visual aids and the teacher can't get a projector and she can't get a computer. And you're going to say to that teacher, we're going to get rid of you. You haven't been producing the right results. And these right-wing sons of bitches, these Republican sons of bitches, these conservative bastards, they look at a situation like that and they don't have a clue what they're looking at. So rather than find the money to make sure that at least the classroom is not 35 kids, at least the woman or the man teaching has some visual aids, at least there's a teaching assistant, at least there's somebody in the school to find kids that are having psychological problems. No, they don't do that. Why not? These stinking legislatures. Well, we don't believe in taxes.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour. Kathy, do you want to I forgot to ask you to get the you got a message or a moment with Bob? There he is. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, it's time for A Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight's Moment with Bob is entitled, I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus. Hey, Mike. It was about 10 o'clock on a cold December night in 1968. I was sitting at my desk in my room at a parent's house looking at the little purple pill I had purchased earlier that day. 100 micrograms of LSD. Fueled by equal amounts of boredom and curiosity, I swallowed it down with some flat root beer and waited for whatever was going to happen to happen. About 30 minutes later, we had liftoff, and I and everything else on the planet was zooming around the sun at about 67,000 miles an hour. Sometime later, who knows when, my watch melted. I had overwhelming realization that all is one and everything is interconnected. Or as the psychedelic Three Musketeers might have said, all is one and one is all. Now, I could have stumbled upon that concept had I ever done any reading about pantheism, the belief that nature is divine and we humans are part of the one interconnected whole. As John Muir wrote, quote, when one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world, end quote. I had not read the Vedas or the Upanishads, nor studied the Greek philosopher Heraclitus. And even if I had, Heraclitus, excuse me, don't send me emails. And even if I had, I don't think it would have had the same kind of epiphanous impact supplied by that little purple pill. As the sun rose, I quickly packed. I took my college textbooks out of my book bag and stuffed in some clothes. I had $7.50 and a half pack of Marlboros. I left my parents' house that morning with the head humming with the last vestiges of the acid. Time to hit the road. Cut to 43 years later. Here we all are, still orbiting the sun at about 67,000 miles an hour on a planet ravaged by the dominant culture that ignores the fact that everything, and that includes us, is part of an interconnected whole. Our civilization is completely dependent upon inexpensive fossil fuels that will run out sometime in the next 20 to 50 years. Naomi Klein said recently, quote, we have entered an era of extremes in the search for energy, end quote. She spoke of the Canadian Alberta tar sands, which are projected to become the primary source of imported oil to the U.S. this year. The process of turning this petroleum-infused sand into crude oil contributes three times more greenhouse gas pollution than it does to produce conventional oil. Naomi Klein said, quote, "We are frantically digging to get at the dirtiest, highest emitting stuff imaginable. This is how civilizations commit suicide, by slamming their foot on the accelerator at the exact moment they should be putting on the brakes." End quote, Naomi Klein. 1.8 billion people will be living with absolute water scarcity within 15 years, and two-thirds of the world population could be subject to water stress when the demand for water exceeds the available supply. And if things aren't bad enough, unchecked global climate change could bring about a total collapse of civilization around the globe. Now, it's a safe bet that Dick Cheney never dropped acid, nor read the Upanishads, but he did come up with an interesting concept on how to deal with possible threats to the security of the United States. It's called the 1% Doctrine. Cheney said, quote, "If there's a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists are helping al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response," end quote. We know the chance of civilization self-destructing because of peak oil, peak water, and global climate change is greater than 1%. And yet the Bush-Cheney regime did nothing about it except deny the danger even existed. Midway through his first term, it is obvious that Barack Obama is not going to confront peak oil or global climate change head on. Like previous administrations, hope remains that gas prices will remain affordable and economy-disabling shortages will not develop until after he leaves office. Scientists aren't in charge of finding solutions to these life or death issues. Politicians and economists are. As Naomi Klein noted, quote, "Climate policy is not made based on precaution, but rather on cost-benefit analysis, finding the course of action that economists believe will have the least impact on gross domestic product. So rather than asking, as precaution would demand, how can we act as quickly as possible to avert catastrophe, we ask bizarre questions like, what's the latest possible moment we can wait before we begin seriously lowering emissions? 2020? 2050? Or how much hotter can we let the planet get and still survive?" It has been estimated that it takes 20 years to switch completely from fossil fuels to alternative forms of energy. We didn't start yesterday. So if we began today, it would take 20 years from now. But nothing's going to happen today. So starting tomorrow, it'll still be 20 years away. Chances are nothing will be done tomorrow either. It looks like it will always be 20 years from someday. If Bill Clinton was one-tenth the visionary he thinks he is, we'd almost be done by now. Michael Ruppert points out in his book, Confronting Collapse, The Crisis of Energy and Money in a Post-Peak Oil World, that the psychopathic elite are actively working against solving our global crisis because they're too busy making money from the collapse. They've got a put option on the planet, and they can't wait to collect. This just in from the Department of Redundancy Department. Psychopaths are crazy. It is not only sheer insanity, but also mass insanity. We can clearly see the bleak future we are hurtling towards, and yet for the most part, we are doing nothing to change it. Why? Are we waiting for a leader? There won't be one. There never will be one. No one on NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, or MSNBC will tell us what to do. A Republican or a Democrat is not going to come up with a plan. We are on our own. Without a leader, it is going to be very, very hard. It seems pointless to conserve energy when a Navy destroyer uses the same amount of oil in a week that the city of Huntington Beach, California uses in a year. What good does it do to conserve water when a Palm Springs golf course consumes as much water in a day that a family of four uses in 4 years? We must do everything we can because of the enormous waste built into the dominant culture. We're the only people who can do anything about it. We don't need a leader to tell us what we already know. We've got to stop. We all have to stop. We've got to just stop. If we don't stop now, civilization will be torn apart in front of our children's eyes. Our actions are mirrored by millions of other people. If we do nothing, Millions do nothing. But if we do something, that action will be mirrored around the world. I believe that because we are all connected, part of the whole. Heraclitus and Albert Einstein thought so, but Augustus Owsley Stanley III made it possible for me to discover it. Disclaimer. Of course I told my children they should do as I say, not as I did. Psychedelic drug use can lead one to astounding revelations, as well as discovering that the moon is trying to kill you. Regards, Bob. Another Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. The murder capitalists who believe that you don't exist. Thank you, Bob. You can find all this at superbeans.com/rant, I believe. Isn't that what it is? I wonder how many people, I should stop for just a moment and explain who Augustus Owsley Stanley III was. Oh, to hell with them. Let them look it up if they don't already know. See, you have to be above a certain age, I guess. There was a time... Never mind. From Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Now, Syria. So, Mike, how are we supposed to get anybody tortured now? Calls for weekend protests in Syria. Social media used in a bid to mobilize Syrians for rallies demanding freedom, human rights, and the end to emergency law. We want freedom. Sami Abdullah, a civil society activist from the initiative Angry Day Syria, using Facebook and the microblogging site Twitter to gather support, said he expected, quote, a lot, end quote, of people to turn up for the rallies in the cities of Damascus, Homs, Aleppo, and Qamishli. He told Al Jazeera from a neighboring country, quote, maybe half of those on the Facebook sites are in Syria, end quote. He also added, quote, many civil society groups in Syria have called for protests. We want freedom, human rights, and the end to emergency law, end quote. And Matt reminds me that Medea Benjamin was on, was at the Cairo march last night. Bless her heart. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
The voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, you can go to English.aljazeera.net. Click on their live feed and look at the pictures, as I'm doing right now. Rabbi Michael Lerner. He writes, ever since the victory over the dictator of Tunisia and the subsequent uprising in Egypt, my email has been flooded with messages from Jews around the world hoping and praying for the victory of the Egyptian people over their cruel Mubarak regime. Though a small segment of Jews have responded to right-wing voices from Israel that lament the change and fear that a democratic government would bring to power fundamentalist extremists who wish to destroy Israel and who would abrogate the hard-earned treaty that has kept the peace between Egypt and Israel for the past 30 years, the majority of Jews are more excited and hopeful than worried. It is impossible for Jews to forget our heritage as victims of another Egyptian tyrant, the Pharaoh, whose reliance on brute force was overthrown when the Israelite slaves managed to escape from Egypt some 3,000 years ago. That story of freedom, retold each year at our Passover Seder celebration and read in synagogues in the past month, has often predisposed the majority of Jews to side with those struggling for freedom around the world. To watch hundreds of thousands of Egyptians able to throw off the chains of oppression and the legacy of a totalitarian regime that consistently jailed, tortured, or murdered its opponents so overtly that most people were cowed into silence is to remember that the spark of God continues to flourish no matter how long oppressive regimes manage to keep themselves in power, and that ultimately the yearning for freedom and democracy cannot be totally stamped out, no matter how cruel and sophisticated the elites of wealth, power, and military might appear to be. You know, I read this, and it's a rather lengthy essay. It's up at Al Jazeera, and I got it from, I don't know what, Common Dreams or Tikkun.org. But as I read this, I think, is he possibly talking, is he considering the Palestinians? Is he considering the Palestinians? He says, to watch hundreds of thousands of Egyptians able to throw off the chains of oppression and the legacy of a totalitarian regime that consistently jailed, tortured, or murdered its opponents so overtly that most people were cowed into silence, is to remember that the spark of God continues to flourish no matter how long oppressive regimes manage to keep themselves in power, and that ultimately the yearning for freedom and democracy cannot be totally stamped out, no matter how cruel and sophisticated the elites of wealth, power, and military might appear to be. I would not try to second guess Rabbi Michael Lerner. He is much smarter than I, much more well educated than I, probably has most assuredly has a greater sense of history than I, where it concerns not just the Jews, but their relationship to everybody else in this tortured part of the planet. But I just wonder if when he writes this, and I don't doubt the emotion behind what he writes. He goes on, he says, it is this recognition that leads many Jews to join with the rest of the world's people in celebrating the uprising, in praying that it does not become manipulated by the old regime into paths that too quickly divert the hopes for a brand new kind of order into politics and economics as usual. But And I don't know. I have to ask the question. Maybe somebody will send me an email. Does Rabbi Michael Lerner say this when the Palestinian people involve themselves in yet another intifada? When the Palestinian teenagers pick up rocks and stones and throw them at Israeli tanks or Israeli soldiers that are coming at them with so-called rubber bullets, which are nothing more than chunks of metal encased in hard rubber. Does Rabbi Michael Lerner, whose writings, I mean, if I were to be religious, if I were to adopt a religion and someone to explain it to me, it would probably be this guy, Michael Lerner. I have great respect for everything I just said. But does he think, when he writes this, it is this recognition of the struggle of people to freedom and justice that leads many Jews to join with the rest of the world's peoples in celebrating the uprising. Celebrating the uprising. I don't see that where it concerns the Israelis and the Palestinians. Do you? What I see in the occupied territories is occupation. What I see is apartheid. What I see is two Semitic peoples, one of which is in control, one of which has all the power, the other of which is not in control, and becomes the object of the misuse of that power. And I've been watching that since the early 1980s. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.